I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad.
What if what we call public opinion was just a manufactured narrative that makes it easier to convince people that if their views are different, then there's something wrong with that, or there's something wrong with them?
There are over 550 million firearms in worldwide circulation. That's one firearm for every 12 people on the planet. The only question is, how do we arm the other 11?
Please shut down the system.
And now for Newsreel. This is your host, Maltos.
It is a good day. This is Mike reporting to you from the internet for Sunday, January 4th, 2015. You are listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global sit-rep on core political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today, and just by listening in and distributing this program, you are too. You can follow along with our news stories and check our facts by going to newsreel.ca. This is a free podcast that can be heard on Rant Radio Talk each and every Sunday afternoon at 1400 hours Pacific time, or again, for non-military time people out there, 2 p.m. in the afternoon Pacific time. So, it's good to be back here, I guess. It's been about, I can't how many weeks, it's about 3 weeks, I guess, since episode 27 back in the last year. So, and we've actually still had stories coming in all that time, which I didn't see until earlier today because, I don't know, Google just sucks. So, whatever. Actually, it's probably my fault, but whatever. I don't care. I'll blame it on Google. I'm cool with that. So we got a good slew of stories here today, but first, we've got some feedback, or sort yourself out, or just random general news, comments, essentially. First thing we have is a message from Snork that came in on, through the website, actually, I believe. Let's see if I can find it now. Oh, there we go. Okay, from Snork says, "Hey there, I recently found newsreel.ca through a recommendation in an EFNet IRC channel. I must say that I like your comment, but I have a hard time listening to your MP3s because of the background music." Yeah, I'm struggling with that, I'm sorry. Do you offer or would you consider offering an MP3 version that doesn't include the music? To answer your question there, Snork, I actually have thought about it, but because of where I'm recording, which is in my empty-ass apartment, there's nothing to absorb sound at all. And even, honestly, blankets and crap doesn't absorb the sound from echoes in this place. It's just the amount of echo that comes across in the raw audio sucks. And, you know, thankfully there is background music, because if you are listening to just me talking with the crazy background or echo in the background, you would just want to probably go and shoot yourself in the face. If somebody knows how to actually kill the hell out of echo in Audacity, that's what I'm using to record. I've played around with the echo reduction and stuff like that, and I have no idea. It's like Greek to me. I have no idea what the hell's going on with that. If anybody knows, hey, shoot me a line, because if it's necessary, that'd be awesome if you do that. Or, I don't know, if somebody wants to give me some advice on maybe where my background music level should be, because I have it up high enough so that you can hear it, but at the same time you still hear my voice, but that kind of gets all messed up, post-production and all that crap too, I think. It sounds, plus I'm running on a microphone with an amp and all that stuff, and even if I'm not, like, my ears pick up sound different than everybody else's, so I think it sounds fine, and then some other people think it sounds like crap, so I don't know, maybe if somebody can give me some insider advice on that, that'd be freaking awesome. But Snork, in the meantime, no voice only at the moment. I'm sorry. You're gonna have to play with your equalizer settings on Winamp or whatever program you're using or device you're using. My bad, I'm sorry. I'm gonna continue working on it. It's just kind of, you know, iffy for me, because I hear things differently than you would hear, and then what Bob down the street would hear and all that stuff. So anyways, the next little bit of feedback we have, or it's not really feedback, I don't think, is from Satan Smurf. And see if we can open up his message here. Dear Maltos, first, I have a link. First, Satan Smurf, I hope you don't mind me reading stuff on the radio. Dear Maltos, first I have the link that I would like to share with you and the listeners. It's howjasay.com. That's howjasay.com. It's a website on how to pronounce words. Very useful when you're arguing with your friends over the pronunciations of words. In brackets, I have dumb friends. Don't we all? Also, I have a question. I got my hands on an M65 military field jacket and was wearing it one day when someone asked me if I had the gloves that go with it. I said I never heard of them, and he mentioned that the Velcro on the inside of this... On the inside of the... Okay, your spelling's off, but whatever. On the inside of the sleeves matched up with a set of gloves when opened. And I have an M65 field jacket too, and I was always wondering what the hell was up with the big freaking... Because they have the normal sleeves, but they pop out and they kind of cover the top of your hand, I believe. And they do have... They are Velcroed. So I thought it was just like a... Kind of like an extra thing to cover the cuff of your mitt. But actually probably is what it is. Let's see. Now, I have seen a few different army gloves before, but don't remember any with Velcro on them that match up with the coat. Have you? And I honestly haven't, because I never thought about looking for them. But I've always wondered why the hell the sleeves are built like that. But I have to say, it's not a bad idea. Those army coats are great for making jacket modifications. With every army coat I have ever owned, the first thing I do is remove the hood. Yeah, because you never use a hood in M65 anyways, and they're just junk. I think it's still designed to wear over a helmet, or I have a small head. Yeah, I think it's designed to be worn over a helmet too. They're pretty huge. Either way, it's just way too big, so I just cut it off and run my earbuds through the zipper on the collar. Adding pockets on the inside is another thing I would like to try someday. Which actually wouldn't be that difficult. You just make a little bag, or just fold a chunk of material over, sew it on three sides, and sew that the inside of your jacket. That's pretty much all that is. It's a cool idea though. On a side note, if I may, I've been playing an online game for the last 8 years or so called Urban Dead. It's a low-tech zombie apocalypse browser game, and I would like to invite all listeners to try it. I can always use more bodies for my zombie horde at Crossman Grove Police Department. Or if you want to play as a human, you can find me at grid6,66. Just go to urbandead.com for that. Not a plug, just a game. So, and last of the holiday season here, I would like to share with you something I think about every year around this time. How well would a Christmas tree ornament work as a Molotov cocktail? Thanks for your time and good day. Actually, the Molotov cocktail Christmas ornament thing would be good, except for the fact that Christmas ornaments being made of glass, it's not the same glass as what a vodka bottle is, or any other alcohol bottle, or any other bottle in general is made out of. It's pretty thin stuff, unless you custom make it. So maybe it'd be fine, but I have a feeling that if you went to whip it, chances are the fuel inside of the thing might actually slosh enough to smash it into your hand. And that's just my thought on it. Any of the wonks have some ideas on that? Hey, send us a message at newsreel.ca or newsreel2@gmail.com. And I actually have one more little bit of news, or I guess news or whatever. This is from Sumerian. Yes, that's right. Sumerian of course, Rant Media fame. I sent him an email a while back asking him about, anything's going on with Rant. And he got back to me a little while ago, about a week and a half ago or so. And he says, hey, thanks for checking in. I've been extremely busy with my current documentary project, so I haven't had a ton of time to throw out Rant, so everything is fairly quiet for the moment. Here's a tidbit of information if you'd like to add it to an episode, which is what I'm doing right now. Work is still being done on After Now's Rachel's Mutt episode to turn it into a live-action short, but the bulk of the work for that will probably take place mid-next year, which is actually mid this year, 2015. Thanks, James. That's all I wrote. Rant is still going. It's just, all the key players are working on their own projects. So that's why it'd be awesome if, all the WOGs kind of, hey, WOG-generated media. Yeah. whatever. There we go. Anyway, so, thank you, James, for that information. I'm sure we all greatly appreciate that from the WOGs. And... let's just get into the news, because I'm starting to trip over my words already. No surprise. Anyways, in mind control news, thank you to Wagga War for this one. Violent TV, this is from the Activist Post, by the way, which I've never even heard of before, I don't think. But and I must put out a disclaimer here again, because I haven't done an episode for about 2 or 3 weeks, some of these are older, what's the word I'm looking for, older news stories. But again, old news is still good news, it's still, as long as it's still relevant, so. Violent TV may make children more susceptible to advertising messages, says a study. And this is from November 19th of 2014, last year. A study by a University of Wisconsin-Madison journalism researcher has found that children who watch television shows with action or violence are more susceptible to messages in the advertisements shown during the programs. I'm going to kill your name, buddy. I'm very sorry, but Eunji Cho, a graduate student in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, why do they put these big freaking names on stuff, says the excitement of a violent show causes children to be focused and attentive, an effect that carries over to commercial breaks. To perform this study, Cho returned to her native... Cho returned to her native South Korea and observed 4 different kindergarten classes. And I said okay on that because Eunji, for some reason, sounds like a male's name, but I guess it's a female name. My bad. Remember, do not judge a book by its cover. You're always going to be wrong. To perform this study, Cho returned to her native South Korea and observed 4 different kindergarten classes. Each class was randomly assigned to watch either Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, is it the new crappy one or is it the old good one? Or A Dog of Flanders, which is a calm Japanese program, which sounds kind of boring. The kids were then shown an ad for chocolate at commercial breaks. Afterward, the children were asked to choose which candy bar they wanted, the one advertised in the commercials or a generic brand. Cho found that students who watched a violent show overwhelmingly favored the advertised product, while those who watched the calm show were indifferent about which candy bar they chose, so they really just didn't care. She also discovered that children who watched TMNT remembered the details of the advertisement better than those who watched A Dog of Flanders. They exhibited a higher brand preference and purchase intention than those who watched the non-violent program. Cho says the study shows how important it is for children to be defensive when it comes to advertising. And by extension, how everybody should be defensive when it comes to advertising as well. We have to teach children what is advertised here. Sometimes get confused between TV programs and advertising, Cho says. When they watch advertising, they have to be ready. Cho hasn't always been on the research side of advertising. After getting a bachelor's degree in communication and media from Seoul Women's University, she worked for Diamond Ogilvy Group, the Korean branch of worldwide ad company Ogilvy & Mather. She spent 3 years there as an accounting executive, planning global advertising campaigns for clients such as Nike and LG Mobile. So the advertiser becomes the anti-advertiser. Interesting. Wanting to learn more and see advertising from the other side, Cho left the industry to attend graduate school. Upon getting her master's degree from the University of Texas at Austin, Cho began working toward her doctorate at UW-Madison in 2010. It was here that her perspective changed. I was really on the marketing side, Cho says. Yeah, so I gotta choke to death here. Mute button. Oh man, that was yum. Anyways, I was really on the marketing side, Cho says. I would always think about how we sell more products. What can be better strategies to attract more people? Cho developed a special interest in how mass media affects youth through advertising thanks to a course taught by Karen Riddle, click on the link there, an associate professor at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Riddle later became Cho's advisor on her research. Quote, the fact that Cho did this project on her own was really ambitious, Riddle says. A lot of grad students will wait until their advisor initiates the study, but she initiated this. Interesting. In collaboration with Sung Chul Yu, an assistant professor of digital advertising at Loyola University in Chicago, Cho published her findings earlier this fall in the International Journal of Advertising. Yeah. So that's very interesting. So, makes sense. You gotta think, well, with the violence and stuff, maybe that kind of jumps your adrenaline up a few notches, even though you're not doing it, but you're watching it, so you more focused on it, you know what I mean? Like, it kind of, that maybe that's what's going on there or something. I don't know. That's very interesting to see. But you got to remember, it's not just kids that are going to be more susceptible to that. I mean, look at most people, the stuff they watch, not necessarily violence, but anything really. And then the advertising that they're bombarded with. And you got to notice also, whenever you watch a TV show, they always cut out right at the dramatic part. So it keeps your attention focused on what comes up in the advertising breaks. Very interesting. But that's all for that story there. And in pirate news, Pirate Bay, sorry, wow, it's been a while since I've done this. Pirate Bay starts counting down to February 1st. This is an article from a few days ago on the 1st of January this year on torrentfreak.com. Very good website to check out. The Pirate Bay has started the new year with an interesting update to the site. The counter that previously kept track of the time that had passed since the raid, which, yes, it was raided on December 9th, is now counting down to February 1st. An official announcement is expected to follow in the near future. On December 9th, like I said before, the Pirate Bay was raided, click on the link there, at the Nacka Station, a nuclear-proof data center built into a mountain complex near Stockholm. Very sexy. Not the raid, but the center. 2 weeks later, the domain became responsive again, waving a pirate flag and a counter that kept track of the time that had elapsed since that raid. During the weeks that followed, there were a handful of changes to the site, including a link to a pirated copy of The Interview and various cryptic messages. Today, there's another update that gives Pirate Bay users hope that the site may be working on a comeback. As of a few hours ago, the counter stopped counting up and began counting down. This suggests that something is going to happen on February 1st, although it's not officially confirmed what that will be. In addition to the uploaded counter, the JavaScript used to display fireworks on the site also has a promising name, allishere.js. Sources previously told Torrent Freak that there were issues with Pirate Bay's backups, but the All Is Here reference may suggest otherwise. A source close to the Pirate Bay team informs TF that more exciting news and an announcement, official announcement, will follow in the near future. Stay tuned for more news. I think that link goes right to, it's just a picture it goes to. Okay, anyways, that's what the Pirate Bay looks like right now, and I checked it this morning, and it is still counting down. So that's actually good, I guess, assuming it's going to come back up. And honestly, even if it doesn't come back up, that stuff can be privatized. Torrent searches and whatnot. Open Bay, Open Pirate Bay or something like that, which isohunt.to, which they were shut down before, and some other group came in and fired isohunt back up, which is another torrent site. Isohunt.to is, they have copies that you can download of the Pirate Bay thing, and blah, blah. I have to look up in that again. I was reading that yesterday. It's actually on those sites yesterday, checking that out. But you have your own copy of the Pirate Bay and all that stuff. So I have a feeling that it's probably not going to, maybe it will come back up. Maybe Pirate Bay will come back up. Maybe it'll be better. Again, they've got probably a few more cards up their sleeve that they can play. But I'm wondering if they're just going to kind of say, yeah, we have this, but it's just going to be distributed by whoever. You know what I mean? Like the Pirate Bay copies and stuff. So maybe that's going down. But anyways, very cool stuff. And you can't kill sharing. One way or another, stuff's going to be shared. So, sorry. Even if it's not, even if it's just offline, like using pirate boxes and stuff, or even just swapping drives, you can't kill it. And it's not piracy if it's just a copy of something. You're not stealing it. It's like going to the library, you steal a book. That's piracy. If you go to a library and take a picture of a book, that's not piracy. It's actually taking a copy of a book. So it's different. And yeah, people go like, hey, well, now it's different. It's worse than that. No, well, whatever. Who cares? It doesn't matter anyways. No way's losing money. People are still buying stuff. So, whatever. And into the next story in aviation news. And this is kind of on the heels of an AirAsia plane being downed. Oh, where was it going? Singapore, I think, wasn't it? I believe. I should check that again. There's been so many plane crashes. But yeah, so this is kind of a bit of a follow-up story, not regarding the same flight, but kind of related. Air Asia plane engine dies just before takeoff from Surabaya, passengers told to disembark. This was on today's date, actually, January 4th, earlier today. In the latest incident to hit an Air Asia flight departing from Surabaya, actually, I think the first one was from Surabaya, too, the engine of a plane failed just before it took off from Juanda International Airport in the Indonesian city, local media reported. The plane had been taxiing for 2 to 3 meters before takeoff when the engine suddenly died, horrifying passengers who heard a loud sound, Indonesia's Metro TV reported. Thankfully, the Bandung-bound plane made it back to the gate, and the 120 passengers on board were then asked to disembark while the plane underwent repairs, Indonesia's Metro TV reported. Passenger Yusef Fitriadi told Metro TV that a man clad in a pilot's uniform told passengers waiting at the terminal that the starter monitor had malfunctioned. Not sure what the starter malfunction, or sorry, starter monitor is. Probably monitors a starter, but anyways. The plane was ready and moved, but suddenly a loud sound was heard. The sound of the engine disappeared, and the plane moved backwards. Not really sure why the plane would move backwards, but okay. We were shocked and panicked. The plane was then pulled back to where it parked, and where we were asked by the stewardess to leave the plane. The passenger was quoted by Metro TV as saying, "The plane was supposed to have departed at 9 p.m. local time on Saturday." Mr. Youssef said that the airline later told passengers that the flight would be resumed after the issue had been attended to, but about 90% of them refused to reboard the plane, fearing that the fault would reoccur during the flight. AirAsia then refunded the plane fare of those passengers who had declined to continue with the flight, Metro TV reported. Very interesting. Now, there's an AirAsia flight that was downed in the Indian Ocean going to Singapore from, I believe, Surabaya is where I was coming from as well. And they're still looking for stuff right now. That's how recently this was. This was just like last week. And yeah, I can definitely see why people would not want to get back on the plane. But I'm wondering here, all these plane accidents are happening, multiple plane accidents, one after another, with multiple airlines. First, it was Air Malaysia, or Malaysia Air, with the downing in Ukraine, and the one before that that they lost in the Indian Ocean, way over in the Indian Ocean, apparently, supposedly. So there's that, and now we have an AirAsia plane a week ago get downed going to Singapore in the ocean, and then you have this thing here. So I'm wondering if maybe there's some form of, I don't know, corporate sabotage going on or something. You know what, Mike? That's a little bit far. It's stretching it a bit too much. Yeah, maybe it is, but maybe it's not. Maybe it actually is. Maybe these guys just have horrible maintenance people on duty or something. Possibly. I mean, things wear down anyways, right? On these things, they have to be replaced all the time. It's a normal procedure. Same thing with a car. You drive a car down the road, something's bound to break eventually. It's just one of those things. But who knows? Maybe it's just something normal. Maybe it's just random how all this stuff's happening. Or maybe it is, again, corporate sabotage or industrial sabotage. I don't know. Just saying. Cue the hate mail. Anyways. In listener licensed news, thank you to Wagga War for this one. Music publishers finally pull the trigger, and they sue an ISP, Internet Service Provider, over piracy. Lawsuit says Cox is the ISP, I believe, blew off copyright notices from two Rights Corp clients. BMG Rights Management and Roundhill Music have sued Cox Communications for copyright infringement, arguing that the ISP doesn't do enough to punish those who download music illegally. Both BMG and Roundhill are clients of Rights Corp, which is a really scary name, a copyright enforcement agent whose business is based on threatening ISPs with a high-stakes lawsuit if they don't forward settlement notices to users that Rights Corp believes are, quote, repeat infringers, unquote, of copyright. Those letters you get in the mail if you download the wrong movie that's being watched, that's like, hey, stop downloading this stuff or we're going to take it to court. It's those letters. Or we're just going to take it to court outright. There's little precedent for a lawsuit trying to hold an ISP responsible for users engaged in piracy. If a judge finds Cox liable for the actions of users on its network, it will have major implications for the company and the whole cable industry. It's one thing to terminate an account on YouTube, but cable subscribers can pay well over $100 per month. And BMG and Roundhill claim that they've notified Cox. They've notified Cox about 200,000 repeat infringers on its network. Yeah, so it's kind of like corporation versus corporation. It's like, oh, we're losing this money, which you're actually not, because people are still going to the movies, they're still downloading music and all that stuff, versus a cable company, which is providing the services. So $100 times 200,000 people is, what is that, $2 million, $20 million in revenues that they could lose? So why would they do that, really? And honestly, in my opinion, it's not, I think that they are obliged legally to do that, but at the same time, like to forward notices and stuff, blah, 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 blah. But at the same time, it's not their problem that somebody's downloading illegal stuff on their network. It's that person's problem who's downloading the illegal stuff on the internet, even though it's not really illegal, but it is. In their complaint, there's a PDF of it there, click on the link, the music publishers describe the Cox network as an out-of-control den of piracy. Today, BitTorrent systems are like the old P2P, so that's peer-to-peer systems, on steroids. Okay, BMG lawyers write, despite its published policy to the contrary, Cox's actual policy is to refuse to suspend, terminate, or otherwise penalize subscriber accounts that repeatedly commit copyright infringement through its network in any meaningful numbers. Cox has ignored, quote, overwhelming evidence, and the complaint lists a few examples. A Cox subscriber account having had an IP address of 70.168.128.908 at the time of the infringement, believed to be located in Fairfax, Virginia, was used to infringe 24 particular copyrighted works 1,586 times since December 9th, 2013. They note, Cox subscriber having a different IP address of 24.252.149.211 engaged in 39,432 acts of copyright infringement over 189 days. Wow. BMG and Roundhill, through Rights Corp, told Cox about all of these infringements, but to no avail. The complaint states that Cox actually has taken measures to avoid and stop receiving those notifications. Okay, suggesting that the ISP was basically treating emails from Rights Corp like spam. And in all actuality, it really is spam. So, whatever. Who's a repeat infringer? The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is a load of shit, passed in 1998, does require ISPs to have a policy to terminate, quote, repeat infringers, but there's not a lot of clarity as to exactly what that means. Does somebody become a repeat infringer when a judge rules that they have repeatedly violated copyrights? So does that mean, like, repeat infringer? So if I download something, or Bob downloads something, you know, illegally, like one of the newest movies, and then he downloads it again, the same movie, does that mean that he's a repeat infringer then? Or that he just downloads movie A and then he downloads movie B, a completely different movie, and then that makes him a repeat infringer? Like, yeah. Have repeatedly violated copyrights. If so, the music publishers and Rights Corp have many more hoops to jump through before they have any hope of beating Cox in court. Conversely, if a judge believes Rights Corp's notifications are enough to find a user is a repeat infringer, then Cox could be in trouble. It's a question most big shareholders, big rights holders, not shareholders, rights holders, haven't been eager to resolve in court because it's a huge gamble. A copyright maximalist outcome could give them more enforcement tools, but if legal precedent gets set in a defense-friendly way, they could end up with far less coverage over ISPs than they have now, so they could get a lot more, but they can also give themselves a shaft, which would be nice if they gave themselves a shaft. since most major ISPs are compromising on the issue and slowly moving forward with a six strike system. So it's like you download six things and you're fired, or not fired, you lose your services. There have been incentives on both sides not to go to the mat on this issue. And Cox, which declined to comment for the story, will surely fight back hard. YouTube came under legal fire from Viacom for not doing enough to boot out copyrighted material, and Google spent $100 million defending the case, even though the economic consequences of shutting down YouTube accounts is almost always inconsequential. Cable companies often bundle internet and TV and phone services, with TV and phone services, and its subscription can cost well over $100 per month. Since BMG and Roundhill have accused 200,000 Cox accounts of being repeat infringers, the consequences of a loss on Cox's side could be massive. So yeah, you're damn well right they're going to be fighting that. And they probably got the money to back it up too. BMG and Roundhill are seeking damages for contributory and vicarious copyright infringement, which is a load of shit, and a judicial order requiring Cox to promptly forward plaintiff's infringement notices to their subscribers. I'd like, just email it to them yourselves, retards. The lawsuit takes place against the background of serious difficulties at Rights Corp. The company is near bankruptcy, having lost $6.5 million since its founding in 2011. Last week, a proposed class action suit accused Rights Corp of violating federal law by using robocall equipment to demand $20 per song settlements from internet users. Cox is far from alone in blowing off Rights Corp's notices, so it isn't clear why the Atlanta-based provider was chosen as a test case. Chances are because it's not one of the biggest ones, so they figure easy target. In a recent earnings call, Rights Corp CEO Christopher Sabic, whatever your name is, you're an idiot anyways, said the 150 or so ISPs that work with Rights Corp cover only about 15% of U.S. internet users. All I have to say about that one is Rights Corp and all the other people that you represent, go stuff it up your ass and fuck yourself. Because, seriously, that's ludicrous. And that's exactly what they're doing. Cox is a smaller company. I mean, a pretty big company, I believe, but they're not going to be as big as, well, Viacom. Or, I don't know, I'm not American, so I don't know all of them. So, they're going after a week. Somebody that's got a good amount of assets, but they're still weak compared to the high-end guys, I guess. That's what I'm thinking, and that's bullshit. And I honestly hope that Rights Corp goes under. Fuckers. And the next news story, this is... Where am I on this list? In Space News, thank you to Exec for this one. Telescope to Chinatopics.com. Okay, random. But whatever. Telescope detects super Earth 40 light years away. And insert picture of the Earth compared to the super Earth. Astronomers using a ground-based... Yeah, screw it. I'm going to read the whole thing instead of the caption. Astronomers have detected another super Earth orbiting its star some 40 light years away. It's not that far. If this was the BattleTech universe and you had a jump ship, you could do 30. The super Earth, dubbed Exoplanet 55 Cancri E... I believe that's Cancri E. Yes, it is. Was seen as it passed in front of its star by the Nordic Optical Telescope located in the island of La Palma, Spain. The exoplanet sun called 55 Cancri can be... What the hell? Like or something? Screw that. There's a lot of spam in this thing. Can be seen by the naked eye as it passes in front of its sun. 55 Cancri E blocks the starlight. And yes, that's how they find planets somewhere else. Isn't that called lensing or something like that? Scientists assume the exoplanet is twice as big as Earth, which is 16,000 miles in diameter. There are five planets orbiting 55 Cancri, and this particular exoplanet is the nearest to its star. Scientists estimate that the surface temperatures on 55 Cancri E can reach over 1,700 degrees Celsius, hot enough to instantly melt metal. So why the hell is that being called a super Earth? If it can do that, it does not have... Earth qualities, I don't think. Might as well be the surface of Venus. Worse than the surface of Venus, actually. Observations of 55 Cancri E prove that ground-based telescopes can certainly detect small exoplanets orbiting sun-like stars. according to study lead author Ernst de Moo. I'm sorry, I screwed up your name. From the Queen's University, Belfast. This discovery is pivotal since upcoming space missions like NASA's TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, and the European, so the ESA's PLATO, Planetary Transits and Oscillations of Stars. They really need to have, I think they have somebody sitting at NASA and the ESA and everywhere else really that comes up with an acronym for, we'll call it TESS. What's TESS now? Let me work it out later on. Or PLATO, because we want it to sound cool, we want to have science, a scientist's name, or whatever the hell PLATO was back in the day. And we'll make it fit. That's whatever. But that's another sidetrack. So we'll discover more smaller planets around bright stars. These discoveries can then be followed up by ground-based instruments such as telescopes. NASA's TESS mission is set to launch in 2017, with ESA's PLATO being scheduled for 2024. Both spacecraft will search for planets in transit around nearby stars. Ground-based telescope detections and observations can further pave way for the discovery of more Earth-like planets in nearby star systems, said Mercedes Lopez Morales from the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. To date, the only super Earth to be studied by a ground-based telescope is GJ1214 Bravo. Very interesting. It's not really super Earth-like. Maybe it's just because it's in the same area. It doesn't really say in this. But, anyways, just look at the news story. How far am I through this list? Halfway through. This is a bit of a long list. There's 8 stories as opposed to the normal 5 to 7. So, yeah. But in Welcome to the Future news, thank you to Bucky Fuller for this one. A restaurant in China has replaced human staff with robot waiters. We are officially living in the future. And those robot waiters, they look so happy with their smiley faces. There's a video, I think it's a video. Yeah, it's a video at the bottom there. They look so happy and creepy at the same time. A restaurant in China's Zhejiang province is making global headlines after replacing all of its human wait staff, with robots. There's a link for that there too. And I bet you it probably made global headlines by pissing off a lot of people in the process too. The restaurant, which is in a mall in the city of Ningbo, is run by 48-year-old Liu Dike, who believes the replacement will save him money by eliminating the need to pay employee wages. Well, he's right. But there's probably maintenance costs on robots too, right? The machines cost $9,400 each and have a 5-year warranty. That's a pretty good warranty. Each robot is equipped with a sensor system that keeps the machine from running into walls, which is handy, or people, which is even more handy, because you don't want to be, you know, running over your patrons with, you know, robot, crazy robot. Women, waiters. Bah! I thought they would have legs, but I guess they just have wheels. It comes programmed with a limited 40-phrase Mandarin Chinese vocabulary, allowing it to both take orders from and respond to customers. A rechargeable battery keeps the robots powered for up to 8 hours. So that's kind of cool, but it's like, oh man, why? Why would you do that? Yes, it's, you're saving money, but I don't know. That's just, it's cool, but it's stupid. Whatever, I guess that's the way of the future. Isn't McDonald's doing something like that with conveyor belts and something? I don't know. Very cool, but very kind of creepy. You could be sitting down having a burger at your local McDonald's or Chinese McDonald's, wherever this place is, and you know, Skynet gives a kill order, and then all of a sudden your waitress is trying to kill you. Interesting. Awesome. Not going to go there, I don't. Well, maybe. I think I do want to go there. I want to see this stuff in action. And into the next story. I'm just clipping through these now. In new tech news, thank you to Weyandi for this one. HP. Yes, Hewlett-Packard. The name of the people who make the machine I'm currently running on right now, which isn't exactly the best piece of equipment on the planet, even though it is brand new, will release a revolutionary new operating system in 2015. Which is kind of scary that they're going to do something like that, because really the only thing good that HP makes is printers. Some of their laptops are okay, but they're not as good. I don't think they've ever been good, really. they've lost their way. New operating system in 2015. Hewlett-Packard's ambitious plan to reinvent computing will begin with the release of a prototype operating system next year. Now, apparently this is from December 8th of 2014, so that means obviously this year, because it says 2015 in the article title, and I am losing my mind because I didn't remember that. Hewlett-Packard will take a big step toward shaking up its own troubled business. There you go. And the entire computing industry next year when it releases an OS for an exotic new computer. The company's research division is working to create a computer HP calls the Machine. Which is, why the hell would you call it the Machine? You might as well just call it Skynet. It is meant to be the first of a new dynasty of computers that are much more energy efficient and powerful than current products. HP aims to achieve its goals primarily by using a new kind of computer memory instead of the two types that computers use today. The current approach originated in the 1940s, and the need to shuttle data back and forth between the two types of memory limits performance. And there's a picture there, close up of the HP Memristor devices on a 300mm wafer. Quote, a model from the beginning of computing has been reflected in everything since, and it's holding us back, says Kirk Bresnicker, chief architect for the Machine. For the Machines. The project is run inside HP Labs and accounts for 3/4 of the 200-person research staff. Wow, so that's 150 people out of 200 on their research staff is working on this stuff. CEO Meg Whitman has expanded HP's research spending in support of the project, says Bresnicker, though he would not disclose the total amount. The Machine is designed to compete with the servers that run corporate networks and the services of internet companies such as Google and Facebook. Bresnicker says elements of its design could one day be adapted for smaller devices too. HP must still make significant progress in both software and hardware to make its new computer a reality. In particular, the company needs to perfect a new form of computer memory based on an electronic component called a memristor. See link right there, memristor memory ready for production. A working prototype of the Machine should be ready by 2016, says Bresnicker. However, he wants researchers and programmers to get familiar with how it will work well before then. His team aims to complete an OS designed for the Machine called Linux++. Not so scary sounding, but the Machine sounds really freaking scary. In June 2015, software that emulates the hardware design of the Machine and other tools will be released so that programmers can test their code against the new OS. Linux++ is intended to ultimately be replaced by an OS designed from scratch for the Machine, which HP calls, Carbon. That's actually a pretty good name. Especially when it's going to be used by a machine called the Machine, which kind of reminds me of Skynet, and Carbon would be, I guess, what the charred remains of human society would be. It would just be Carbon. Programmers' experiments with Linux++ will help people understand the project and aid HP's progress, says Bresnicker. He hopes to gain more clues about, for example, what types of software will benefit most from the new approach. And chances are, if it's a better computing system, wouldn't all types of software, benefit from this? The main difference between the Machine and conventional computers is that HP's design will use a single kind of memory for both temporary and long-term data storage. Existing computers store their OS's, programs, and files on either a hard disk drive or a flash drive, so SSD. To run a program or load a document, data must be retrieved from the hard drive and loaded into a form of memory called RAM. That would be your random access memory, if we all remember. That is much faster, but can't store data very densely or keep hold of it when the power is turned off. HP plans to use a single kind of memory in the form of memristors for both long and short-term data storage in the Machine, not having to move data back and forth. I remember hearing something about this kind of memory. I don't think it was called memristor back then. It was called, RRAM or RDRAM or something like that. It's like, yeah, you turn your computer off and you turn it back on. Let's say you copy some text. You can paste that around as much as you want when your computer's on. Turn your computer off, you want to do the right-click paste, there's nothing to paste. If you had RDRAM in your computer, you would copy something, paste it where you wanted to, shut your computer off, turn your computer back on, and continue pasting where you left off. Yeah, I think it's called RDRAM. Or it was, or something. Maybe I'm wrong. Somebody can fill me in on that. Existing data storage. Yeah, existing computers, I already read that part. Or density or keep when power is turned off. HP plans to use a single kind of memory in the form of memristors for, I guess it's memory transistors, for both long and short-term data storage in the machine. Not having to move data back and forth should deliver major power and time savings. Memristor memory also can retain data when powered off, should be faster than RAM, and promises to store more data than comparably sized hard drives today. So I guess it's pretty much just a computer with a RAM bank, really. Or banks of memristors. No hard drives or anything like that. It's all just... So you have your SSD and that's it. And the SSD does double duty. Huh, interesting. The machine's design includes other novel features such as optical fiber instead of copper wiring for moving data around, which would be a hell of a lot quicker because optical's a lot better than copper. That's why they use it for data transmission now, like for internet at your home and whatever. HP's simulations suggest that a server built to the machine's blueprint could be 6 times more powerful than an equivalent conventional design, while using just 1.25% of the energy and being around 10% of the size. Wow, that's you get a 6-fold jump in power, like computing capability, essentially, and you'd be using 1.25% of the energy. Wow, and being 10% smaller. Nice. HP's ideas are likely being closely watched by companies such as Google, well, you know that they will be, that rely on large computers or large numbers of computer servers and are eager for improvements in energy efficiency and computing power, says Yumak. Wow, that's a name and a half, says you are a professor at Georgia Tech. That said, a radical new design like that of the machine will require new approaches to writing software, says Rama, says Mr. R. Mr. or Mrs. R, whatever you are. There are other prospects for reinvention besides HP's tech. Companies such as Google and Facebook have shown themselves to be capable of refining server designs, and other new forms of memory, all with the potential to make large-scale cloud services more efficient, are being tested by researchers and nearing commercialization. Click on a link. There's 2 links there, actually. HP may also face... skip the paragraph. Right now, it's not clear what tech is going to become useful in a big way, says Stephen Swanson, an associate professor at the University of California, San Diego, who researches large-scale computer systems. HP may also face skepticism because it has fallen behind its own timetable for getting memristor memory to market. When the company began working to commercialize the components, together with semiconductor manufacturer Hynix, in 2010, the first products were predicted for 2013, which we all know didn't happen, because we would have it right now. Today, Bresnaker says the first working chips won't be sent to HP partners until 2016 at the earliest. That's very cool. So that's, is that really oh, my computer's screwing up. So yeah, that's very, very cool. Bit of a paradigm shift? It's quite a paradigm shift. That's very awesome. And just a little finger on the side, which I just noticed, it says, why it matters. U.S. data centers consumed 91 billion kilowatt hours of electricity in 2013, twice as much as all the households in New York City, according to the Natural Resources Defense Council. So 91 billion kilowatt hours, you're going to be running a lot less. I don't know. 1.25% of 91 billion kilowatt hours of electricity is, but it's a lot less than that. So that is very cool. That's actually extremely cool. This is starting to get into quantum computing and stuff. Or getting closer to it anyways. And in our last news story for this week, we have in Gen Idiot News, or Generation Idiot News. Thank you to Weandi for this one as well. This is from The Telegraph, by the way. Young people are a lost generation who can no longer fix gadgets, warns professor. We'll skip down here to the actual story, because there's a thing there that's not loaded. It's probably a video. This is from December 28th of last year. Young people in Britain have become a lost generation, and probably not just in Britain, who can no longer mend gadgets and appliances because they have grown up in a disposable world, the professor giving this year's Royal Institution Christmas lectures has warned. Daniel George, professor of radio frequency engineering at the University of Manchester, claims that the under 40s expect everything to just work and have no idea what to do when things go wrong. Now, I must put something up in favor of the idiot generation, is that they're not all idiots. There are quite a few people out there that, from that generation, am I part of that generation? Yeah, I'm under 40, but I don't know. I like to think I'm not a part of the millennial generation, even though I guess I am, depending on what source you look at for when the generations start and actually end. So maybe I'm a sub-generation. I don't know what the hell that is. Anyways, so stupid. There are people out there. So I guess this should say the majority of them, or a good chunk of them anyways. Unlike previous generations who would make do and mend, now young people will just chuck out their faulty appliances and buy new ones. And not just that, they will also say, oh, this phone is old, it's last year's model, or it's 6 months old, it's an iPhone, let's say the iPhone 4. I don't like Apple anyways, but we'll say the Apple iPhone 4, 4S. Oh, well, there's an iPhone 5 then now. Oh, I'm going to get that because, well, do you really need it? No. Well, why are you getting it? Oh, I want it because it's better. It's the same damn thing. They can run the same operating system on it, really. It's just, I guess, maybe a faster processor and not even that much faster. Same thing with the iPhone 6. Well, I know that's a revolutionary Apple design, blah, blah, blah. Yes, I'm going on a big sidetrack here. But they'll throw it out if it doesn't work. And hell, they'll throw it out if they just want the next one just because it's new and improved, even though they don't really need it. Buy new ones. But Professor George claims that many broken or outdated gadgets could be fixed or repurposed with only a brief knowledge of engineering and electronics. Yes, they could. So you could have a small little external display made of your old iPhone or Android phone that you could tether to your computer, and probably wirelessly tether to your computer. Know what? You can do that. So that would be an example. This year's Royal Institution Christmas lectures are entitled Sparks Will Fly, How to Hack Your Home. She's hoping... It's Danielle. Okay, my bad. She is hoping it will inspire people to think what else they can do with common household objects. Ideas include using a magnifying glass and shoebox to turn a mobile phone into a rudimentary projector. That kind of works. How to use tin foil to make two small batteries, like super small batteries. Oh, okay. There we go. Batteries that are too small to fit correctly into a spot that it needs a larger battery. That makes a little bit more sense. There we go. And how to turn a bottle of water into a lamp. Okay. Professor George said, we've got a lost generation that's grown up with factory electronics that just work all of the time. All of these things in our home do seem to work most of the time, and because they don't break, we just get used to them. They have almost become like black boxes, which never die. And when they do, we throw them away and buy something new. But there's now a big maker community who are thinking hard about what we do with all these gadgets. They are remaking and repurposing things. I talked to someone who had used some LEDs on his bike so that he could put up a message as he was cycling. The first lecture broadcast on December 29th is inspired by Newcastle inventor Joseph Swan, who demonstrated the first working light bulb in 1878. During the lecture, Professor George will attempt to play a computer game on the windows of a skyscraper using hundreds of light bulbs. During the lecture, she will also demonstrate how to send wireless messages using a barbecue. That's a bit random. Control a firework display with a laptop. I can see that. Use a torch to browse the internet. Torch as in flaming stick, or torch as in British torch, which is a flashlight. turn a smartphone into a microscope, you can see that, how to turn a washing machine into a wind turbine. That would be doable because that's just a motor, and a turbine is pretty much just a motor that's being driven in reverse, I do believe. And how Lego can solve a Rubik's Cube. Oh man, if I had known that when I was younger, freaking awesome. Hundreds of websites have emerged in the last few years where users post ideas about some hacks in electronics. Professor George added, I want young people to realize that they have the power to change the world right from their bedroom, kitchen, table, or garden shed. Today's generation of young people are in a truly unique position. The tech we use and depend on every day is expanding and developing at a phenomenal rate, and so our society has never been more equipped to be creative and innovative. Unfortunately, most of that's going to waste. When I was 8 years old, I was given a telescope by my parents, and I was fascinated. I would get up in the middle of the night to watch lunar eclipses. It was the first time I realized how math and physics could be used in a practical and useful way, and I knew immediately that this kind of hands-on investigation was what I wanted to do in life. If we all take control of the tech and systems around us and think creatively, then solving some of the world's greatest challenges is only a small step away. I believe everyone has the potential to be an investor. Gail Cardew, Director of Science and Education at the Royal Institution, said, our aim is to bring to life the incredible ingenuity, innovation, and creativity of engineering. The Royal Institution Christmas lectures have been taken by many distinguished scientists since they began in 1825, including Sir David Attenborough, Carl Sagan, Lord George Porter, and Dame Nancy Rothwell. They will be broadcast over 3 days between December 29th and December 31st on BBC 4 at 8 p.m. And this is a little bit late for that, but at the same time, I'm sure you can find it somewhere on the internet. Yes, that's a very, that's a good article. There's a picture there, what's it say? I don't know. There's a few pictures and they're not even loading because my internet sucks. I think they're throttling my bandwidth, bastards. So that was the end of the news stories for this week. We don't have a daily hack for this week, I'm sorry. There's one or two things that I could have put in, but I had to take a look at them a little bit more before I actually put them up, because I didn't check them out. So into Cyberpunk Kit, we have RFID blocking genes. Thank you to Kevin as a Geek for this one. Genes made that will prevent digital pickpocketing. How long is this? I'll read it anyways. The genes have pockets that block RFID signals. Well, that's really all you need to know. It's a pair of genes with RFID blocking pockets. So if you have a credit card or a debit card with a microchip in it, or probably anything that has your identification related to it, you know, just throw in your genes, and obviously RFID blocking is usually shielding of some sort that actually prevents stuff from connecting to it. So you put your cell phone in your pocket. Oh, that would be a bad thing for your cell phone, because you wouldn't be able to get signal. But essentially, it's the same thing as you put your cell phone in, I don't know, a Faraday cage, so a microwave or something, underground even, and it blocks the signal. That's what these things do with your credit card, so nobody can access the information. If you get what I'm saying. Hopefully you do. If not, read that story. And we've got a few things for Rec Media this week. We have five things, actually. The first three are from Juver. Three videos. One is Tank shoots at a camera. sorry about that. So take a look at that. It's very short. It's a tank shooting at a camera. It shows you the, he didn't get hit by the camera or by the shell. So, yay ballistics. Gives you an idea of what bullets actually do, and large artillery rounds, etc., when they actually fly through the air. They don't fly straight. The next one is, the only way to tell the truth is with fiction. And I actually saw chunks of that, and it was actually pretty good. It was at DEF CON 22, I believe, is where that was filmed. And that, I'm actually going to watch that after I do Newsreel today, after we get all post-processing done. So check that out. Sounds pretty cool from what I've seen so far. Check it out. And the next one from Duver is Vintage Ray Mears. Ray Mears is just one of the survival guys. Go check that stuff out. I think that was filmed in 1995. So, the next Rec Media is The Internet Must Go. Thank you to Bucky Fuller for this one. I've seen a few chunks of this too. It's a guy that goes out. It's a stage thing, really. But he goes out and talks to people who run big businesses, and whatnot, I think two or three of them or whatever. You know, wow, we want to do that internet fast lane, slow lane thing, blah, blah, blah. And these people with these startups and big businesses and stuff, like, well, if it had been like that, these companies wouldn't exist right now. You know, blah, 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 blah. So go check it out. I can't explain that properly, but it's actually pretty good. I think it's like about an hour long or half an hour long. Half an hour, I think. So check that out. And the last little bit of Recmedia is something that I've known about it for a while, but I didn't have a computer until recently, and I forgot it. That was beefy enough to handle it. And I can't know about it since last year anyways. Or 2013 when I was living in Costa Rica. But I love BattleTech. I love MechWarrior, BattleTech, all that stuff. The tabletop game, even though I haven't really played it a lot. The online games, the computer games, etc., etc. Very cool stuff. The cartoon, that's what got me into it. No, it's not canon, but whatever. All that stuff is good. The novels, everything's a huge universe out there, and it's pretty much just about war. I love it. But MechWarrior Online is a game. Think about MechWarrior 4 or 3 or whatever MechWarrior PC game you've used, and make it a hell of a lot more modern, make it look actually realistic, but still be the original BattleTech MechWarrior stuff. Man, that game's freaking awesome. Go download it. It's in an open beta right now. Most of the mechs are purchasable. Like, it's a freemium game, really, pay to play or whatever. Freemium, I guess. If you want all the high end mechs, like if you want a Vulture and use it as a missile boat, you could do that, but you have to pay money into it or buy the when they launch stuff or whatever. Go check it out. It's awesome. I got two mechs there already, a light and a medium. You can buy them in any order you want. I'm just going light to heavy. Light the assault, I should say. And very sexy stuff. You can join up with a clan, or you can join up with the Inner Sphere factions and stuff like that. So check it out. Very awesome stuff. And as WOGs, we should all like Mecha. And obviously we do. So just, yeah. Awesome stuff. Check it out. Download it. Can't matter how big it is. 7, 8 gigs or 20 gigs or something stupid. Very good stuff. Go check it out. I keep going to keep saying check it out because it's awesome. Do it. But, so that's all we have for you today. But don't worry, we'll be back next week to make sure you get the news that you need to survive. This has been a free podcast brought to you by the WOGs Who Care. If you cannot donate to the show, please distribute. But if you can donate, please do so by clicking on the Donate tab on the Rant Media website. And I'm going to put this out here a little bit more for donations, is send some donations to Hugo over at Red Octagon Studios there, because that's where the audio, all the shows are actually being hosted. Used to do it on archive.org. We'll probably do that again a little bit later on. I'll probably do that again later on, I should say, because there's no we anymore, it's just me for the time being. But definitely send some donations over to Hugo at Red Octagon Studios, which is all WOG setup. So do that because, you know, why not? Keep that stuff going. And he's got all the Rant archives up there anyways, too. So one more reason to feed donations to them. The Rant Media website. Thank you to the Army of the Flying Monkeys and their assistance in gathering data. If you have information, music, or comments that you'd like to send us, you can reach us at newsreel2@gmail.com, or you can send us the information through our website at newsreel.ca. If you like the music in the background, be sure to check out an album called Hellbilly Deluxe by Rob Zombie. Yes, an old album. We'll be fading out now with a track from Carved Souls called Waveform, which is an extended mix of it, apparently. Remember, everyone, we will never defeat the enemy if we are at each other's throats. So until next time, that's what Server said. End of line.
There is a place we'll go. Reactions within. Choices that I've not been. Only to correct what has been denied. In time you may find me hiding. Relieve the pains and pretend I'm okay. Soon enough the change will find. Nothing is clear inside my heart.